bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, life, and insight.
We welcome you with joy.
Truth to tell, this is why I come back. You're all so lovely, and I've enjoyed every time I've been here, so thank you for inviting me again. This is also my favorite topic, so I was also pleased about that. My task was to do an overview of Christian spirituality, not to address things in the book necessarily, but to give you a kind of overarching view to use as you read the book. And as you go through this wonderful series, I'm so envious. I'm hoping to show up for some of them when I can get away, because I think it's a great project that you've set out for yourself here. When I thought about this, I realized that to do an overview of Celtic spirituality in 45 minutes, it would be something like, they came, they conquered, they got thrown over, they were exiled, and you know, could go like, that's about it. But I'm going to try to do more than that, and I want to really engage you in this. So as I've said before when I've come, while I'm talking about all this, if you think of something that you really think should be included, put your hand up and I will think about asking you to say what you want. As long as you're good and not go too long, that is great. But it's nice to have a kind of interaction. And then in the second half of the morning, we'll definitely interact and share some practical ways of using what we've learned so far. I'm grateful to Martha for providing these maps. I love maps. And this helps, because when I talk about the history of the Celts, this will help you to see what we're talking about. Also, I think it's wonderful to have all these wonderful Irish, Celtic, Scottish names in print so we can actually see them. And I discovered something in preparing for this, that there is a website where you can go and get pronunciations for hard to pronounce things. Isn't that great? Well, I think an overview of Celtic spirituality has to begin in the first millennium BC in Central Europe at the beginning of the Iron Age. So you see that if we go back and take a look, we can get an idea about what we have left. It'll help us to see. Now, all we have from that period is archaeological evidence. We have a few historical documents from Greek and Roman sources to help us kind of piece together at least a glimpse of Celtic culture at that time. It's rough because the Greeks and the Romans mainly engaged the Celts in war. And so what you get from them is a great discussion of how ferocious they were, how nasty they were, how barbaric they were, etc. So we have to parse that with other things that we find. When we look at their artwork, for example, their amazing metalwork, when we look at the handed down narratives in song and story, we see another picture that balances those things. But we do have to go back and see a little bit more about where they came from. We know that they had no written language, so they were a completely oral tradition for most of their history. And so we see that left over, don't we, in Irish songs, in stories, ballads, and in their love of talking. You know, that's the way it was carried on. If you're going to carry everything in your head that you know, you better have some way of singing it or having poetry if you're going to have to memorize all that stuff. And so that's what they did. So they had a druidic priesthood whose job it was to carry all that in their minds, in their heads. And so they were able then to tell it over and over. The story is that it took them, many of them, 20 years to do it, to be trained enough to be able to carry the story on for the next generation. So they were actually, within the tribes, the judge, the teacher, and also were able to teach rhetoric in later times, in classical times, to Greek and Roman people who wanted to train their children in this ability to be able to present their arguments. And evidently, the Celtic Druids were very, very good at presenting their arguments. It would have been wonderful to hear them, wouldn't it? I like to imagine what it would be like if we could have just a sound of how that was in that wonderful language and in their passion for everything. It would be wonderful. We can only imagine. One of the other things, and I've picked some things that are important for Celtic spirituality. There are many, many details of their history. They're fascinating. But the things that I thought we should think about are the fact that they had this amazing, strong belief in the afterlife. So much so that the stories tell us from the Greek and Roman accounts that they were willing to pay their debts in the afterlife. Now that's pretty confident, isn't it? I think that's pretty good. We know that that they worshipped in sacred groves. We've all heard stories about the oak groves and how all the strange and wonderful things that happened in those worship places. We know that they were somewhat nomadic, but they also would settle down at times and build things up a bit, and they must have been able to do that because the archaeological evidence shows that they had settled enough to develop iron, bronze, overlaid metals, very complicated technical art that they were able to do. They couldn't do that if they were just wandering around. But their attitude was, it seems from reading this, that they really didn't hang on to material possessions like most people of their time. They wanted them to be portable. They wanted only what they cared about. They didn't care about having a city that was going to be a state or organized. They weren't big on organizing things. They preferred to be able to move. They loved cattle. And we have the earliest narrative in Irish lore is the cattle raid of Cooley, you know, that wonderful story. So that was part of their way of being. They were also very ferocious. There's no doubt about it. When they decided they wanted to take over something, they pretty much were able to do it literally by terrifying their adversary. You know, when you read any accounts of the Romans, when they encountered the Celts, when the Celts were invading them, it's a pretty amazing set of stories. They described how they would come into battle with no clothes, completely vulnerable, with a big shield, but not as big as the Romans had. They would fight to the death. They were not afraid of dying because they believed in the afterlife. They figured it really didn't matter. So they would just go at it. And they would also yell. So they had a lot of noise and chaos, and you can only imagine what that was like. So when we hear about Celtic history, when we read things, we have to realize that a lot of what they wrote about was because of that. Because the other side was, they also were reflective, they loved beauty, they had an amazing art form throughout the whole period, all the periods of Celtic history. We also know from reading their history that they conquered most of Central and much of Southern Europe from 500 BC until the Roman conquest of Gaul by Caesar. So if you look at your map, the one that shows the monasteries of Ireland, Scotland, and Europe, this map doesn't include their whole territory. They went all the way to Turkey, to Galatia. It was amazing, their spread. If you look at maps that show their territory at that time, when they really were at their peak, it was immense. Now, they were not all exactly alike, of course. They were threads of various things that came from all parts of Europe. But they had some basic similarities that we've already talked about. And they had a language that also identified them. But by 50 BC, the Romans had conquered them and pushed them all the way out to the western fringe of their civilized world, which would have been, on your map you can see, it would have been the Outer Hebrides, the outer, you know, from Iona all the way down, the outer western area of Scotland, Ireland, parts of Wales, and that was about it. They had been moved all the way. Now, what's interesting for us is that the overview of Celtic spirituality will be primarily from that outer fringe, because that's what we have left. That's what we can look at to see what made this different from, as Bob said earlier, from the Roman influence in Christianity. So Celtic Christian spirituality has a different thread, a different worldview, a different way of praying, a different theology, really, which also got them into trouble, as we know. Christianity came to Britain around the beginning of the 3rd century, and it endured a long persecution until the 5th century, when Constantine made Christianity the official religion. So we had a period there where the church in this fringe area was being persecuted, but deepening its life in ways that we can see when we look at what's been passed down to us. What's fascinating to me is that this part, this Celtic part of Christianity, really was much more Eastern, much more the Desert Fathers, much more influenced by St. Anthony of Egypt. It's amazing when you go, there's a place in Ireland in one of the high crosses where there are two central figures at the top, up in the, where the cross meets. There are these two figures. And we know that one of them is Anthony of Egypt and the other one is Paul of Thebes. Both of them Egyptian desert fathers. Now, where did that come from? You know. But this is the kind of remnant that it's wonderful to reflect on and think about. So we can imagine in the trade routes that came up on the in the West, that years before Christianity came from the West, from the East, it had also come from this train, from Orthodoxy, actually, from the ancient church, before the splits. So this is a wonderful source for us, that we can go back and reclaim something that was lost. I think we all like doing that. I think it's what we've probably been about, to reclaim what's been lost, to reclaim things that perhaps fit more with our own human experience. Their prayers remind me of the prayers in Judaism, the prayers for every part of the human body, every bodily function, all of that. This is very similar to that. A very Celtic way of praying is to actually see no difference between praying about something in your body as praying in a very pious spiritual way. There's not a separation here. And that's very helpful, I think, for us to see. We also know, and we can certainly tell from Martha's great maps here, that this was a monastic kind of spirituality. And that really was very similar to their early tribal way of being. So if you can imagine the tribal way, and if you've been to any of these ancient sites in Europe or Ireland or Wales or Scotland, you may remember seeing those hill forts with the big ring, you know, everything was inside, protected from the outside. Well, that's also a lot like the monastery. You know, it's got a wall, it's got things go on inside. So this was not a hard switch for them when Christianity came to the early Celtic world. They could see that this fit, that their high king, could be Jesus. That would be an easy shift. And so it was really a kind of bloodless takeover. There was not a lot of martyrdom when Christianity came to this part of the world. They were able to integrate it in a way, but that was because they just made sense of what was already there. They matched the two together, and they began living pretty much the same as they had before, but changing the names of things, beginning to see things in a new way, but not completely different. So an example of this, which I love, is the story of Bridget, Saint Bridget. She was the best example I could find of the way the church, in her wisdom at the time, adapted to what they found. We know that when Christianity came to Celtic Ireland, Wales, and Cornwall, the missionaries had a hard time getting rid of the pre-Christian Celtic Bridget. She was very important to them. She was a triple goddess. She represented three stages of a woman's life: the young virgin, the mother, and the old wise woman crone. Three stages. The feast, her feast day was February 1st, and it was a big feast day. It was primarily a fertility ritual associated with the return of milk to ewes. Is that a wonderful thing? You know, that would be so celebrated that it would be translated into a Christian saint. This ability to see the similarities between the way God operates in nature and the way God operates in human life. This is an amazing example. So they weren't going to give this up when they converted to Christianity. It was in their bones. So the church made the Feast of St. Bridget her saint day. She actually was Bridget of Kildare, who was part of a monastic community, and so they named it for her. They allowed her to take over the functions and the attributes of the Celtic goddess. She was a 6th century abbess who ruled over a double monastery of men and women, but she is also Bridie, Celtic goddess, and keeper of sacred wells. I went to Ireland and Cornwall in years past, and I went there looking for the well sites, the ancient wells. Amazing. They're still there. They're still worshipped. Secretly, perhaps. But if you go and find one out in the woods, the way you find it, you have a map, which usually isn't very good, but you see it because there are little ribbons tied to the trees or the bushes. Little votives hanging on twigs. And you know that the local people are coming there. You also see it left over in my own tradition, in Anglicanism, in England, with well dressing. Some churches in England today still have a feast where they have the dressing of the well. And they have beautiful flowers around it. And sometimes they've translated that to the baptismal font, and they do it with that. But there's that ancient, ancient carrying over of this awareness that when water comes up out of the ground, something sacred is happening. So the breaking down between the earth and heaven has been amazing in these stories. You can see it. And so we no longer have to ask ourselves, is it true? We only have to ask ourselves, what does this tell us about God? What did this tell them about God? What did they make of this? And what can we make of it? That looking at the earth and its amazing source of goodness would give us a clue about how God is in the world. How nurturing, how sacred. I remember years ago that Dawn did a workshop in which she said, what would we do if we lost the ability to think of water as sacred. It would be a huge loss for us. But we don't think about it much because we don't draw water from a well anymore, do we? Hardly any of us, I'll bet you. We turn on the faucet and we don't probably even know where the water comes from. Well, maybe some of you do who are very ecologically minded. You may know where the water comes from. But we're so disconnected that we forget the sacredness of things like water coming up out of the ground in the spring. So for the Celtic people, those things were primary. But the wonderful story about Bridget keeps going because she's also the daughter of the innkeeper in Bethlehem. Oh, yeah. And so we know what happened there. Well, she was left in charge one night. Her father went away, left her in the house with a small amount of water and a small amount of bread, and he said, "Don't open the door to anybody until I come back. You only have enough for you." Knock at the door. Guess who? There they are. She invites them in. Finally, she takes a look and she realizes, oh, this is too bad. So she gives them the water and the bread. And then she comes back in the house and the water and the bread have been restored. So she knows that something is up. So in the night, she goes out to see what's going on and she gets there just in time to help Mary deliver the baby. Oh, yeah. And because poor Mary didn't have enough milk, she suckled the baby. So we owe her a great deal. Well, you see how it goes. You know, you go from the coming of milk into the ewes on the feast day of Bridget to this story about Mary and the baby and Bridget filling in for the becoming the wet nurse, essentially.
That's a great story.
I love this story. There are many of those stories. I just picked this one. But the wonderful thing is that it kept alive something very ancient that we have lost, and that is the sacredness of the normal rituals, the normal ways in which natural life happens, the way the world works. I mean, it's a miracle that we're even alive, but we forget that until we're sick. You know, we just take so much for granted. Well, they lived very close, as we know, to the edge. So we don't want to romanticize Celtic life. It was very, very tough. They were overrun many times. They starved a lot before the potato famine. That was bad, but before that, it was even worse. So in all those years, they were able somehow to keep their life going by remembering that God was on their side. You know, that God was in them. God was in the earth. God was in the natural world. So they couldn't avoid it. They could go outside and hear the birds, and they knew that God was singing to them. And they really believed it. One of the wonderful things that I've read that Celtic mothers would teach their children was a little thing that was made into a sort of like a song that said something like, "You hear those birds singing to God? Well, how do you stay quiet?" So that's how it was. Now, we can also see that because Bridget was Celtic, she had no problem traveling back and forth through time and showing up whenever or wherever she was needed, right? God immanent in all things. Sun, moon, wind, earth, sea, mountains, valleys, springs, streams. All signs. Not actually presence of God. There was this split before between matter and spirit that we've carried over into our own life. That was to our detriment. George MacLeod, the great Iona figure, says, "What's the matter is matter." Our understanding of matter being dead, you know, not really spirit-filled. So you're going to have a great time here this year because you're going to hear about Kayard, you're going to hear a lot of things that will open your minds and your hearts to this notion about matter and spirit being together. And so the story of Bridget helps us see that somewhat. She also carries with her another image that I love from Celtic lore. That's actually a very ancient part of Celtic tradition, way before Christianity. You know, they had a cosmology that was something like a giant soup kettle, a cauldron, into which everything went and out of which everything came. And so this, you know, is carried over in the if you remember in Macbeth, the three witches stirring the pot, this is the triple goddess with the cauldron. Ancient image of how it is, what it's like. You know, we can think of the universe and infinity and it makes us feel kind of crazy. You know, but this kind of helps us contain it. That there is a source, and it's integrated source. It's something out of which we all come and back into which we all go. So in some ways, it would have been helpful to us to keep this alive, because we would reverence the earth a whole lot more than we ever have in the West. We would begin to see that it is our source, and that into it we will go in one way or another. So when we use the term we die out, I think we should say we die in. We go back into our source. So this image from the ancient goddess carried over in Bridget is helpful to us, I think. Well, by the middle of the 7th century, the Roman Church had lost so much ground in this part of the world that the leader of the northern province was not the Bishop of Canterbury, but Columba, the Abbot of Iona. And the monks looked not to Gregory, the Pope of Rome, but to Columba for their guidance. So by 660, Rome was moving to regain the ground she had lost and began the pressure for conformity. They needed to bring the two parts back together because they were losing ground up there and they knew it. One of the underlying issues was, as always, theology. And it shows us how much difference theology makes when we look at this. The theology of the Celtic Church was really Pelagian, and you're going to hear more about him, you're going to read about him in the book as well. We know about Pelagius because it's the heresy, the Pelagian heresy. That's what's in my mind. That's where his name ended. But he taught that God is present in all living things, that creation is essentially good, that in the birth of a child, God is giving birth to God's image on earth. How about that? He wasn't big on original sin. He was not. So the strife in the church began really with that. It had been brewing for a long time. And it's wonderful to think about our own theologies, and we've all put them together for ourselves. I know that because I do spiritual direction and I hear how we've come up with it, you know. But we can look at our theologies, what it is we really believe about God and God's relationship to us and to the earth, and then kind of hold that next to what we're going to learn this year about this way of seeing God, understanding God. It's a pretty amazing thing when you look, because I think once the split happened and things became conformed as much as that's possible, we forgot that this was a possibility at one time, that we could believe that every child born is an image of God right now with nothing needed. Just as it is, that we have in us a source of God that we can draw on, deep source of God. That's kind of news to us. At least it certainly was to me when I first began to look at this. So what happened was that things got a little messy because the strife in the church with this underlying theology, that was bad enough. But you know, it always comes down in the church to the pew cushions or something, doesn't it? You know? It always does. And in this case, the issue was that the king in Northumbria was married to the queen had come from Canterbury. So she was Roman, from the Roman part of the church. What difference does that make? He celebrated Easter on a different day, a different week than she did, which meant that while he was still in Lent, she was celebrating Easter. That was rough. You know, they couldn't quite figure out how that was going to go. So finally, it began to influence the people, and the king learned that many people were beginning to fear that they were not truly Christian if they weren't in conformity with the rules of Rome. So he called for the great church council in Whitby. Hilda, the abbess of that monastery, agreed to have it. And you see on your map where it is. Thank you, Martha, for these maps. You see it's spelled W-H-I-T-B-Y, but sometimes it's spelled with a D. Right up there on the coast of, northern coast of England, below Lindisfarne. So if you want to read something absolutely fascinating, you can look up the Venerable Bede's History of the Church. And in it, he describes pretty much exactly what happened. And it's pretty amazing. First, the king made a speech in which he said that those who serve one God ought to observe one rule of life. And as they all expected to be in the same kingdom in heaven, they shouldn't differ in the celebration of the divine mystery, but they ought to inquire which was truer and follow it. Does this sound familiar? Some things don't change. Well, the Irish monk Coleman represented the Celtic Church, and he presented the case that his date was based on the teachings of St. John. Now, we know that the Celtic Church, the Gospel of John was their primary source. It fit with their understanding of the way things were, and so that's what they loved. And Philip Newell has written another book that you may have seen called Leaning on the Heartbeat of God, Listening to the Heartbeat of God, and that's taken from this imaginary image that St. John leaned against Jesus at the Last Supper and listened to his heartbeat. So there was all that going on for the Celts. So Coleman presented his case that not only was it based on St. John, but it was in accordance with the early church practice of the Passover. It fit with the season of the Passover. But the Roman representative, Wilford, argued that his date was based on the teachings of St. Peter. But here's the coup. At the end of the argument, he quoted this passage from Matthew. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell cannot prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Uh-oh. Then the king turned to Coleman, according to Bede, and said, is this true? And Coleman said, yes. He then asked if that much authority had been given to him. And Coleman said, no. And the king said, quote, then I will rather obey the doorkeeper of heaven, lest when I reach its gates, he who has the keys turn his back on me, and there be none to open them. And the rest, as they say, is history. And so we lost this elemental connection to the earth. Now, years ago at Trinity, I was preaching on Thursdays at times, at the Thursday evening Eucharist, and it fell to me to preach on the feast day of St. Hilda. And so I started thinking about this a lot, and what I thought about, I reflected on the church that might have been. the kind of church we would have had if these had not been split, if they had been merged. How would that have been? I think it's a great thing to reflect on, you know. So let your mind go, let your imagination go, and imagine what it would be like now. Think about our liturgies. Think about the ordination of women, for example. Think about all those things that have divided us all up over the years. Think about what it would be like if we had that balance of this amazing source of elemental wisdom that we all carry around in us, that we don't use very much because we don't need to. So it'd be fascinating to reflect on that, I think, if you want. I'm gonna cheat and take 5 more minutes since we got a late start.
Mm-hmm, sure.
One thing that reclaiming, one of the reasons I think that you're all interested in this topic is that you've already begun, probably years ago, to reclaim parts of this tradition for yourselves. And I think that's wonderful because it gives us an awareness of God in the here and now, not as an abstract idea. It gives us a sense of immediacy that God is present in every second, every nanosecond. Now we know about nanoseconds. That the natural world is infused by God, that God can be actually seen in every plant and insect, every bird and animal, every human being. That by looking at creation, we see God revealed to us, alive. Now, we have a long way to go to reclaim all that, but I think we've begun. And I think the church has begun also in its own slow pace to reclaim some of it. And that's hopeful. Because we don't have a lot of time left, in my opinion, to get the earth straight in our own theologies and in our own spiritual life. But this after 11:15, I'm going to share with you something that was collected in the 19th century by Alexander Carmichael, who traveled through this whole area of the Outer Hebrides and Ireland, collecting prayers and songs from people whose grandmothers had passed them down for generations. And they will give us an insight into the spirituality that allowed them to treat ordinary tasks of daily life sacramentally. Now that would change a lot if we could do that. It helps us to reclaim a sense of God's immanence in creation and in the daily round of human tasks, so that we don't have to say, well, I'll pray when I can go on a retreat, or I'll pray at church, or I'll, you know how we are. And we all share this. This is no judgment. It's just the way it is, that we've lived so long with this dualism of sacred and secular that putting them back together again is hard work. So some of these little prayers may help us do that. So we'll do that afterward. And I brought handouts for all of you for that. I also put some handouts. I don't think I have enough, unfortunately, for everybody. I had them left over from a retreat years ago. A reading list that you might want to look at. I stopped using it because a lot of the things were out of print. Well, now I know we can get things that are out of print very easily. So take a look at it. I think it's back on the back table. Before we break, are there any things you can't wait to say? Well, okay, so let's take a 15-minute break and then we'll come back.